Well, good evening, everyone. How are you? Good. My name is Amy. If I haven't met you yet, I would love to meet you after the service. I'm one of the ministers here, so it'd be great to have a chat. A couple of months ago, I went go-karting with a bunch of the other church staff. Now, I'd never been go-karting before, and I kind of expected that the go-kart would be a bit like Fred Flintstone's car, right? So I'd power it by moving my feet. And I kind of figured that we'd all take turns driving around a nice circular track. I'd just get to go at my own pace, and it would be great. Now, I was more than a little freaked out when I arrived and saw a gang of testosterone-charged guys hooning around the track, which was windy and sharp and tight. Engines roaring, they're racing each other, you know, about 60, 70 Ks. This isn't what I thought I was getting myself into. Well, eventually, it was our turn. On the one hand, I was glad I was about to put on a Formula One racing car helmet, because this looked pretty dangerous. On the other hand, I thought, I'm going to get some pretty bad hat hair after this, and it kind of smells like BO, like you don't know where it's been before. We got into our carts, and apparently I had the recipe for success. I was the smallest and the lightest, so my cart could go the fastest, if only my feet could reach the pedals. Well, the race began, and the seven of the people I was racing with, they sped off into the distance. Well, I sort of tentatively put my foot on the accelerator and just made my way out of the pit stop. I approached every sharp turn at a snail's pace, and when I entered the dark tunnel, I went even slower, much to everyone else's annoyance on the track. I managed to slam into every possible obstacle, regardless of how slow I was going, and every few seconds, someone would whoosh past me. I have a big startle reflex, so my nerves were really on edge at this point. So I started to pray. Please, God, let the traffic light turn red. Please, God, let the traffic light turn red. Well, eventually he answered my prayer and the first race was over. Now, Rod, youth pastor, was bouncing off the walls, had the best time of his life, and he couldn't wait to get back on the track. Me, on the other hand, I decided I'd had enough. I didn't want to race anymore. So I went up to the spectator's lounge while the other guys kept racing. I got in trouble a little bit later because apparently they were power sliding and overtaking one another like pros, and they kept looking up to the spectator's lounge and they wanted to see me, you know, giving them an encouraging smile. There was no one else watching them. But I was too busy tweeting to cheer them on. The book of Hebrews compares the life of faith not so much to a go-kart race but to a running race. And as Christians, we're encouraged to shake off everything that holds us back and never stop running the race marked out for us. But the life of faith, it's not like it's a 100 meter sprint, is it? You know, you don't just have a smooth, straight path to follow. So what do you do when life is actually full of sharp turns and you can't see what's around the next corner? What do you do when you feel like you're in a dark tunnel or you're approaching a huge hurdle? What do you do when you hit what looks like a dead end in your relationship with God? Do you do what I did on the go-kart track? Do you slow down, shrink back? Do you think, I don't want to race anymore? Do you give up on God? Well, the book of Hebrews directs our attention to the grandstand. It's full of ancient heroes of faith. They've already finished the race, and they're eagerly watching us and cheering us on. Last week, we heard about Abel, Enoch, and Noah, and this week, we get to hear about one of the other heavyweights named Abraham.
Friends, we're in Hebrews 11. It's on page 1191. In the Bibles in the trays in front of you, or it's on the handout you would have received as you came in. Hebrews 11, verse 1. Now, faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. This is what the ancients were commended for. Verse 8. By faith, Abraham, when called to go to a place he would later receive as his inheritance, obeyed and went, even though he did not know where he was going. By faith, he made his home in the promised land like a stranger in a foreign country. He lived in tents, as did Isaac and Jacob, who were heirs with him of the same promise. For he was looking forward to the city with foundations, whose architect and builder is God. By faith, Abraham, even though he was past age and Sarah herself was barren, was enabled to become a father because he considered him faithful who had made the promise. And so from this one man, and he as good as dead, came descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and as countless as the sand on the seashore. All these people were still living by faith when they died. They did not receive the things promised. They only saw them and welcomed them from a distance. And they admitted that they were aliens and strangers on earth. People who say such things show that they are looking for a country of their own. If they had been thinking of the country they had left, they would have had opportunity to return. Instead, they were longing for a better country, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. By faith, Abraham, when God tested him, offered Isaac as a sacrifice. He who had received the promises was about to sacrifice his one and only son, even though God had said to him, "It is through Isaac that your offspring will be reckoned." Abraham reasoned that God could raise the dead, and figuratively speaking, he did receive Isaac back from death. And chapter 12, verse 1, "Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us."
So the question tonight is, what can we learn from Abraham about how to live with faith? If the microphone were handed to Abraham in the grandstand, what would he say to us to spur us on? Well, according to Hebrews, he would be calling out at least three cheers from the grandstand. The first cheer that Abraham would be calling out is this: run into the unknown. Run into the unknown. Have a look at verses 8 to 9 again. By faith, Abraham, when called to go to a place he would later receive as his inheritance, obeyed and went, even though he did not know where he was going. By faith, he made his home in the promised land like a stranger in a foreign country. He lived in tents, as did Isaac and Jacob, who were the heirs with him of the same promise. You see, the city of Ur was all that Abraham had ever known, but at the ripe old age of 75, God called him to take a sharp turn and run into the unknown. Leave your country, Abraham. Leave your family. Leave all your familiar surroundings. Leave your creature comforts and go to a new land. But Lord, where am I going? What's this land called? Abraham, I'll tell you when you get there. A pastor by the name of Stuart Babbage had four large photographs hanging in his office, or so the story goes. They were virtually identical pictures of open desert. Someone asked him, "Why do you have four pictures of pretty much the same thing?" And he replied that recently he had visited the ancient ruins of the city of Ur. Standing at the centre of the ruins where there was once a fertile and thriving civilization, he pointed his camera to the north, to the east, to the south, and finally to the west. And he realised, no matter what direction Abraham went in, he would have been greeted by dry, sandy, endless terrain. But nevertheless, he obeyed and went, even though he did not know where he was going. When Abraham reached Canaan, God appeared to him again and said, "This is the new land." And as Abraham looked around, he realized he wasn't alone. The land was already occupied by the Canaanites, and he was a foreigner. Now, some years ago, while I was standing in an Egyptian train carriage, I had that uncomfortable sense of being a foreigner in a strange country. I was a young white girl, and I stuck out like a sore thumb in my jeans and tee in a carriage packed like sardines with other women who were wearing big, heavy tunics head to toe, the full head scarf. Some of the women only had their eyes showing. Now, I'd been there a week. I was getting used to the different culture. I was getting used to the way people pointed and stared. But it went to a whole nother level that day on the train carriage. One of the women started yelling. And I don't know why she started to do this. I have no idea still to this day what she said. She was speaking in Arabic. But it became very clear she was talking about me. She was poking fun at the way I looked and how different I was. And everyone was laughing their heads off. I have never felt so out of place and desperate to get off that train and get home. And that's the situation Abraham found himself in, out of place. I bet it would have been tempting to return home to where it felt safe and secure. But he stayed. He spent the rest of his life homeless, wandering around in a strange foreign country, sleeping in a tent. So why did Abraham run into the unknown and stay there? Well, it says this in Hebrews 11 as well. For he was looking forward to the city with foundations, whose architect and builder is God. They admitted that they were aliens and strangers on earth. They were longing for a better country, a heavenly one. You see, Abraham knew that he did not belong here, not in the city of Ur, not in the land of Canaan, not anywhere on this earth, for that matter. He anticipated a heavenly city designed and constructed by God with unshakable foundations. And here's the thing. He wasn't going to get too comfortable. He wasn't going to put down roots anywhere else. So are you being called by God to run into the unknown? I'll never forget walking into the shoebox apartment of a couple named Norm and Jean in Bangkok. They were renting one tiny room with a little ensuite. They had literally just a mattress on the floor and like a camping cooktop thing in the corner of the room. Norm and Jean had been pretty wealthy in the Philippines, and when they felt called by God to leave their country and to go and be missionaries in Thailand, they gave up their secure salaries. They literally sold all their possessions. They obeyed and went, even though they did not know where the next dollar would come from. And as a church, you guys know that we support other people who have done the same thing. There's Josh and Naomi in India, James and Beth in Germany. But it's not enough to simply cheer other people on. We're not spectators in the grandstand yet. We can't just sit around here and watch other people run. Is God calling you to join them? But don't worry, you don't have to become a missionary, pack up all your belongings and move countries to run into the unknown. It just means responding with obedient action, even when you don't know what the outcome will be. It could be as simple as having a conversation with someone about Jesus, even though you don't know how they'll respond. It could be that God is calling you to increase your generosity at church, to maybe give an amount that kind of makes you squirm, and you do it even though you don't know what it will mean for the future. What's stopping you from running into the unknown? Perhaps we're just too comfortable here. Have you put down roots where instead you should have been putting down tent pegs? You know, it's pretty easy to do in the hills. We have wealth and pleasure at our fingertips. We've become content, haven't we, with domestication. We just want to live nice, safe lives, blending in, being comfortable. We have forgotten to look forward to heaven. Well, Abraham is cheering us on tonight. He says, run into the unknown. Run, even if it costs you your security and your comfort. God knows what's around the next corner, and you can trust him. He's leading you home. The second cheer that would come from Abraham in the grandstand is this: don't let hurdles trip you up. Hebrews 11:11-12 says, by faith Abraham, even though he was past age and Sarah herself was barren, was enabled to become a father because he considered him faithful who had made the promise. And so from this one man, and he as good as dead, came descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and as countless as the sand on the seashore. After being married for decades, Abraham and Sarah had not been able to conceive a child and had pretty much given up hope. That was until God spoke to Abraham. He said, Abraham, look at the heavens and just start counting the stars, if you can. That's how many descendants you're going to have. This promise sounds miraculous to our ears, but I dare say to Abraham, it was like a hurdle in his way, an obstacle to his faith. Now, my most dreaded sports lesson in high school was hurdles. A doctor once diagnosed me as being anatomically small. And so I felt like the hurdles came up to here. And I didn't really want to run at a plank of wood with metal poles. So I'd be at the beginning of the track. I'd be jittery, thinking it's just obstacles in my way and I don't know how I'm going to clear it. When it came to my turn, I would take my mark, get set and go. And one of two things would happen. I would just shake off the fear, hope for the best, run really fast, smack into the hurdle and fall in a heap. Or I would sort of run up to the hurdle and chicken out at the last minute and then just try and climb over it. To Abraham, this outrageous promise would have been like a hurdle in his way, with his grey hair and wrinkles, with his arthritic bones and joints. The writer to the Hebrews describes him as good as dead. And his wife was infertile. So how could they even have one child? How could he keep trusting God in the face of something so impossible? There were 25 years between promise and fulfillment. 25 years of staring down the same hurdle. 25 years of gritting his teeth and digging deep and persevering in faith. And if you're feeling like Abraham's a bit heroic, a bit too hard to relate to, then you've got to know that he was human as well. And sometimes he let hurdles trip him up. He had his own moment of doubt. He slept with a young maidservant, conceived a child with her, and then said to God, can't this son be the one who receives the promise? Well, nevertheless, by the grace of God, he got up again, and by faith, he cleared the hurdle. He did conceive a child with his wife named Isaac, and their family was one step closer to becoming a great nation. So how did Abraham clear the hurdle in the end? How did he believe that outrageous promise? Did you see it in verse 11? It says, because he considered him faithful who had made the promise. Abraham knew that God was always reliable, true to his word, and incapable of breaking a promise. The faithfulness of Abraham actually was founded on the faithfulness of God. So are you letting a hurdle trip you up? Perhaps there is an outrageous promise from God, and you've just been quietly thinking, how can this happen? Like, seriously. You think that surely in your circumstance, it's impossible to have faith. Maybe you know that God has promised that he won't let you be tempted beyond what you can bear, that he'll provide a way out when you're struggling with sin. But you're thinking, not with this sin. I've been struggling with this sin for years. I can't conquer it. I might as well give up. Perhaps you know that God has promised that the gospel is powerful to save. No heart is too far from his reach. You're thinking, not with this person. This particular person, I can't ever imagine them putting their faith in Jesus. I think I'll even stop praying. Or maybe you know that God has promised that he is able to heal your body. He is able to fix your marriage, to solve employment problems and provide for you when you're in a tough spot. But it seems unlikely, and you've just put whatever it is in the too hard basket. God can't do that. Maybe you've been staring down a hurdle for a long time. You've been gritting your teeth. You've been digging deep and you've been persevering. Well, Abraham is cheering you on tonight. Don't let hurdles trip you up. Keep running. Keep trusting. God is faithful, so you can clear it. The third cheer coming from Abraham in the grandstand is this. Don't be fooled by dead ends. Don't be fooled by dead ends. Verses 17 to 18. By faith, Abraham, when God tested him, offered Isaac as a sacrifice. He who had received the promises was about to sacrifice his one and only son, even though God had said to him, "It is through Isaac that your offspring will be reckoned." Sometime later, God called out to Abraham again, and this time he said, "Abraham, take your son Isaac, whom you love, and sacrifice him on the mountain." I can only imagine that Abraham was horrified at this point. What? Take my Isaac, my boy? I love him. I've got to kill him? God wants me to kill him? But it's through Isaac that God said he was going to make a great nation. This doesn't make sense. Why is he putting me through this? Abraham had run into the unknown. He had cleared impossible hurdles. And now he hit what looked like a dead end. Isaac literally appeared to be a dead end. So he stopped in his tracks. He couldn't get past this. All his faith in God for the future was dashed. He decided he didn't want to race anymore. And he gave up. Right? Wrong. Abraham was not fooled by dead ends. He built an altar. He bound up his son. And he laid him amongst the wood. He took a knife in his hand and he reached out towards his son to kill him. And right at the last moment, God spoke again. "Abraham, don't move a muscle. Don't hurt the boy. I can see that you trust me." You see, as it turned out, this whole thing was a test. It was a test of faith. And Abraham passed it with flying colors. He didn't even hesitate for a moment when it looked like he had hit a dead end. So why wasn't Abraham fooled? Why didn't he give up at that point? Verse 19. Abraham reasoned that God could raise the dead. And figuratively speaking, he did receive Isaac back from death. Abraham unwilling to believe that God was going to break his promise, so convinced by this point in his life of the faithfulness of God, figured, well then, God must be going to raise Isaac back from the dead. It's the only explanation. When he held that knife to his son's throat, he expected to return home later that day with his son, with the promise still intact. He knew that there are no dead ends with God. Have you ever hit what looked like a dead end with God? Have you ever been in a situation thinking, I can't get past this? Have you ever felt like this is the end of the line? You're giving up on God. The Bible often uses words like trials, suffering, and affliction to describe the way that God tests our faith. It also explains that God doesn't test us to be mean. He's not trying to make us fail. He's not getting some sick pleasure out of heaping down suffering on us, trying to make us fail. Satan tempts to bring out the bad, but God tests to bring out the good. It reminds me of when I was learning to ride my bike. I was really good at riding my bike with the training wheels on. And I used to love spending Saturdays outside the house riding up and down the cul-de-sac that we lived in. There came a day, though, when I walked into the garage and my dad was fiddling with my bike. And, Dad, what are you doing? I'm going to go for a ride. Well, he had decided it was time to take the training wheels off. Now, I didn't want this to happen. I loved my training wheels. I was very happy to ride with them. And I was afraid of what would happen if they weren't there. I didn't want to crash into the pavement and get all scratched up. And so I resisted with a lot of tears, mind you. My dad, he persevered. Not because he wanted to watch me fail, but because he knew I was ready to test my skills. And he knew that I would show myself to be a better rider, even if I got a few scratches along the way. If he hadn't have tested me, I would probably still be riding with my training wheels on. In the same way, God tests to bring out the good. James 1:2-4. Consider it pure joy, my brothers, whenever you face trials of many kinds, because you know that the testing of your faith develops perseverance so that you may be mature and complete. Sometimes you might hit what looks like a dead end, but the truth is there are no dead ends with God. If Abraham, who had never heard the story of the cross, knew that, then surely we who have heard the story of the cross should be even more certain. It's the story of how the Heavenly Father was willing to sacrifice his divine Son for us all. But in this story, there's no last-minute rescue. Jesus really did suffer and die. Jesus was not bound up and laid amongst a pile of wood with a knife to his throat. But Jesus was nailed to a wooden cross. He was lifted up and he had a spear thrust into his side. Certainly, it looked like Jesus had hit a dead end. But God raised him to life again. That's the definitive demonstration. There is no dead ends with God. And through faith in him, we share in that victory if we keep on running until the end. So whether it's illness or whether you're even staring down at the face of death itself, when we get to the finish line, we will be raised to life again. And so Abraham is cheering you on tonight. Don't be fooled by dead ends. Come what may, you can get past it. Don't give up. There are no dead ends with God. We've heard the cheers of Abraham from the grandstand. How should we respond? Hebrews says, let us shake off everything that holds us back and let us never stop running the race marked out for us. Any questions? The question is, what if we do not know what God's calling us to do? How do we know what God's calling for our life? How can we find it? I think Abraham was in a different situation to us. He obviously didn't have the word of God to open up and flip through and search for wisdom to all of life's questions. This was before that had been written, before the Old Testament had been written. And so God spoke to him, I guess, maybe audibly, thank you. Perhaps in a vision, perhaps with someone visiting him. So that's how he found out what God was calling on him to do. The question says, what if we do not know what God's calling us to do? I think we do, in the general sense. Like, obviously, you might not necessarily hear go to Thailand, go to India. You might. God might put a passion on your heart. But in the general sense, we know what he's calling us to do. He's calling us to live with faith, to go and make disciples of all nations, evangelize the world, live holy lives, all the things that the Bible sets out for us. So the place to start is in his word, and to pray for his wisdom as we go through life. I think it's James that says when you pray for wisdom, God will give it to you.